The headlines. Iran says it is serious and ready to strike a good agreement in talks over reviving the 2015 deal if it serves its national interest. Palestinians hold a funeral for a teenager killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank amid tensions in a flashpoint neighborhood of occupied outputs. Bahrain's top Shia cleric and the main opposition group Al-Wefaq condemned the appointment of a naval Israeli officer to be stationed in the country.
Welcome to the studios near the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Iran's top security official says the fate of the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA, has not come down to a political decision by the U.S., obviating the need for speculations. In a tweet, Tadi Shamkhani said the negotiations have reached a stage which does not require guesswork, and the result can now be definitively declared. He said that the U.S. must decide whether it will embrace or refuse to accept the requirements for a reliable and durable agreement based on principles agreed to in the JCPOA. Meanwhile, the Iranian foreign minister says the country is serious in hammering out a good deal within the framework of the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdollahian also urges seriousness from other parties in this regard.
We believe if the U.S. and the three European countries show seriousness in returning to the full implementation of their commitments under the JCPOA, reaching a good agreement in a short term is achievable.
Amir Abdollahian also noted that the American side sends messages of goodwill, but practically does not take any tangible actions. He said that Tehran is keen on reaching a swift agreement in Vienna, but this should be within the framework of Iran's national interests. Abdollahian also urged Western powers to stop what he called playing with time. He made the remarks during a presser with his Irish counterpart in Tehran. Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA are engaged in diplomatic efforts in Vienna to restore the accord which was battered by the U.S. unilateral withdrawal in 2018. Homo Leske is a correspondent joining us from Vienna to bring us up to date with the latest on these talks. Homo, over to you.
Yes, Papa. So today we heard that the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Bagheri-Kani, is having another meeting with the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, which is ongoing behind me in the Coburg Hotel. Yesterday, there was a string of meetings between Mr. Mora and Mr. Bagheri, and we're hearing that they were very detailed and intensive talks. And Iran also held separate negotiations with the Russians and the Chinese. Now, as to the process that we're in right now, there was some speculation that maybe the sides could decide to have a joint commission session. That has not been in any way confirmed. And we're hearing both, as you said there, from Iranian sources in Tehran and others, that the sides are still continuing the negotiations and believe that they should continue. At the moment, while they are saying, maybe some of those who are following the talks are confused because there are mixed messages. While some say that significant progress is being made, Mr. Ulyanov last night tweeting that all the participants, the U.S. and the 4+1, agree that the things are moving positively and that they have a positive assessment. At the same time, this doesn't mean that there is going to be 100% an agreement. What sources close to the Iranian team are saying at this stage is that after that 10-day break that we had in the middle of the eighth round, the Iranian team came back with a new set of proposals or solutions to the outstanding issues. That initiative was given to the other side, and the expectation is, of course, that the Iranian side is waiting for the response to that set of proposals. We are also hearing that this written exchanges of either comprehensive packages on all the issues or proposals on specific issues. Topics. It's something that's quite normal in the process of these talks and has been happening since these talks began. But I think just reading between the lines of what you said there, Mr. Amir Abdollahian, the Iranian foreign minister, has said, and also separately what the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security, Mr. Shamkhani, has said via Twitter, is that if the necessary political decisions are made, particularly by the Americans, then things can happen pretty quickly. And what that means is, of course, the issue of verification and guarantees also specifically, because Mr. Amir Abdollahian, in his comments, and you were just referring there, he said nothing that's tangible has yet been presented to Iran to prove to Iran that the Western side, particularly the U.S., has this good faith in practice when it comes to full compliance, because Iran has said time and again that promising to remove sanctions on paper is not enough. We need the required verification. And also, can the Americans give the guarantees that they will not withdraw from the deal again or reimpose sanctions? So we'll have to see where things are headed from this stage on.
Great. Thank you very much for that. Amalezgi there from Vienna. We appreciate it. Moving on, the Palestinian Prisoner Association has announced a comprehensive strike in all Israeli jails amid new controversy over the Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. The call for strike comes amid confrontation between regime forces and Palestinian protesters over the planned eviction of residents' families and demolition of their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. Protests erupted on Sunday after a far-right Israeli lawmaker visited the area and opened a parliamentary office there. 30 Palestinians were injured after Israeli forces and extremist settlers attacked the protest. Regime forces remain heavily deployed in the neighborhood. Meanwhile, hundreds held a funeral procession in northern West Bank for a Palestinian teenager who was shot dead by Israeli forces. The 17-year-old was shot in the head during a protest against the Israeli demolition of a Palestinian home. The protesters initially managed to prevent the demolition in the town of Jenin, but regime forces returned to the area and razed the structure overnight. Israel frequently destroys the homes of Palestinians allegedly involved in attacks on settlers. That's besides separate demolitions under the regime's settlement expansion policies. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent Ramallah Mona Kandil, who gave us the details on the Israeli violence in Jenin and in Al-Quds.
What happened is that Israeli forces with their armored vehicles and jeeps, tanks, raided the village of Silat al-Harithiya in order to destroy the home of a Palestinian prisoner, this Palestinian prisoner, Mohammed Jaradat, whom the Israeli authorities accuse that he carried out a shooting attack against Israeli settlers. The Israeli troops were intending to destroy his home. Clashes erupted between the Palestinians living in the village of Silat al-Harithiya and other villages around this town with the Israeli forces. They retreated back. However, in the early hours of this morning, Israeli troops returned to the village of Silat al-Harithiya and succeeded, unfortunately, to destroy the home of Jaradat, this Palestinian prisoner. Elsewhere in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, the situation is still tense, with Palestinians are still protesting the settlers' attacks, settlers' aggression, and they clash together, the settlers and the residents of Sheikh Jarrah, and even the protesters who had been there. A number of Palestinians were wounded because at the end of the day, of course, Israeli forces attacked the Palestinians, protecting and giving the support to the Israeli settlers in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah.
Bahrain's top cleric has called on all Muslims to stand against any compromise with the Israeli regime and its expansionism. Sheikh Isa Ghassam says the Muslim community has the responsibility of opposing Israel's oppressive policies. He has slammed the deployment of a senior Israeli officer to Bahrain as another sign of Israeli colonialist measures. On Saturday, Manama confirmed the stationing of a high-ranking Israeli officer in Bahrain as part of an international coalition. The move was also criticized by Bahrain's main opposition group, Al-Wafaq. The group said that the ruling Al-Khalifa regime's decision for such an appointment was an attack on Bahrain's sovereignty. Al-Wafaq also questioned the popular legitimacy of the Bahraini regime, saying that the Al-Khalifa is on a quest, to obtain a, quote, fictitious power from the Zionists. The Bahraini uprising is still ongoing even after 11 years since it began, now in its 12th year. No matter how hard the regime has tried, whether it was banning major political opposition groups or by the total suppression of human rights, Bahraini people mark the anniversary of the country's uprising against the Al-Khalifa regime.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill-treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini courts' dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al Wefaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wefaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centers. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq Movement, Hassan Mashaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdul Jalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution.
Bahrain has come under pressure from human rights organizations over its prison conditions, including overcrowding, poor sanitation, and lack of medical care. This also includes sham trials that were held. There have been many reports of regime torture on the detainees. Manama has gone to great lengths to clamp down on any sign of dissent.
Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community. Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
Saudi warplanes have carried out air raids on the Yemeni capital Sana'a, targeting a communications system near the telecom ministry. Yemeni sources say the strike destroyed the Tele Yemen telecom company building and damaged a neighboring building. Riyadh claims the ministry is being used by Yemeni forces to control drones targeting Saudi positions. The coalition had earlier asked civilians in Yemeni ministries in Sana'a to immediately evacuate. Last week, Yemeni forces said that they had hit a military target at the Saudi Abha International Airport with a drone. The Yemeni army, backed by popular forces, has been intensifying its attacks in response to the ongoing Saudi-led war and blockade, which have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. A correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali, says Saudi Arabia is targeting Yemen's communication centers to further isolate the crisis-ridden country.
The Saudi-led coalition has started a new campaign to target several residential areas, alleging that these buildings are being used to launch attacks against Saudi Arabia. But the residents there haven't never seen something like that. And the Saudi-led coalition needs to prove if the Yemeni army is really using these buildings or these places for launching attacks against the Saudi facilities. They are only trying to isolate the Yemeni people from the world. They are targeting the communication system of the Yemeni people. We know earlier that they have targeted the international gate, which connects the whole Yemen to the internet connection in Hodeidah, and the Yemenis have been isolated for a few days, and now they are attempting to do the same thing to isolate the Yemeni people so they can commit further crimes, further war crimes, and target new residential areas. They don't have a proof that these areas have been used for launching any military operations against Saudi facilities. People here, they are aware that the Saudis are trying only just to scare the Yemeni people and to spread horror among the people in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. The Yemeni army is launching the military attacks from outside the cities. They are not being from inside the city. Otherwise, we will see the missiles being launched or at least the drones being launched against Saudi Arabia. But nothing of that happened.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. A busy bazaar, as if all the people are here. You might ask yourself why I have come to this bazaar. Indeed, I am here to buy some souvenirs for my friends. Tonight, I'm going to take a trip to Yazd to visit my friends there. Also, the day after, I have planned to visit the ancient village of Kharonag. Kharonag village dates back to 4,500 years ago, and is surely a spectacular place to visit. The historical village of Kharonag is located in Yazd province, 70 kilometers to Ardekan County. In this region, there are iron ore, zinc, and granite mines. There is also a protected area in this region which is home to animals like wild goat, goat, sheep, mufflon, wildcat, caracal, and cheetah. Kharonag, which used to be called Khuranag in the past, means the place where the sun rises or the place where the sun is born. Kharonag village has placed one of the large adobe structures of Iran in itself. This village has two parts. The new part in which over 500 people live, and the old part, or the castle of Kharonag, which is damaged and empty. Some of the must-see landmarks of this village include Kharonag Castle, the historical bath of Kharonag, Kharonag Caravansarai, Kharonag Mosque and Hosseiniye, as well as the shaking minaret of Kharonag. I am now in Kharonag village. This village is ancient, and I'm so excited to see it. Kharonag village dates back to the Sassanid era. This village used to be a place for taking rest by merchants and travelers. Let's look around the village together. I am now at Kharonag Castle. This castle dates back to the Sassanid era. Well, this castle is surrounded by deep moats. These moats were used as a way to protect the residents of the castle against enemy forces. Six guard towers are attached to the body of the castle. There are 80 houses in this castle. In most villages of the Yazd city, you see nothing but adobe and mud. Oh, I'm so thirsty. My flask has run out of water. What a scent! The smell of wet earth is very pleasant. I'm crazy about this scent. Kharonag village, like the city of Isfahan, has a structure called Shaking Minaret, or Minar Jomban, which shakes. This minaret also dates back to the Sassanid era. Its height is 15 meters. The shaking minaret of Kharonagh used to have three floors. Its top floor used for watching and lighting. It used to have a wooden structure on its top, which had been tilted because of earthquakes and wind blow. So the locals of Kharonagh had detached it and brought it down. To be honest, I don't dare to get close to it. I am now at the center of Kharonagh Castle. Here, there is the Kharonagh Jame Mosque. This mosque dates back to the 8th to 10th century AH. Adobe and mud are the main materials used for building this mosque. Though, as it shows, bricks are also used in the minarets and facade of the mosque. It's very beautiful and spectacular. Actually, Kharonagh has many must-see places to visit, and unfortunately, I can't describe them all for you. Just tell you one thing. Don't miss the night sky of this region if you happen to visit here. The stars in this region are so near to you that you feel you can touch them all with your hands. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
One instance of Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullah wasalamu alayhi showing that form of, or this the example that we're looking for, this is how we need to be towards the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. And then based on what the Prophet says, be that way towards Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayh. And based on what Ali ibn Abi Talib and the Prophet said, be that way towards Hassan ibn Ali, and then Hussein ibn Ali, and then Ali ibn al-Hussein, and then Muhammad ibn Ali, all the way until the Imam of our time, Ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salawatullah wa salamu alayh, in the context of the conquest of Mecca, it seems this was, a letter was sent from Medina to notify the mushrikeen about the attack that the Holy Prophet is planning on Mecca after the Meccans broke the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. Hudaybiyah was a 10-year treaty and agreement. After 3 years, the mushrikeen broke that treaty. The Holy Prophet was told, they broke the treaty, you're going to not uphold your end. They are not trustworthy. They are people who have broken their pledges and their agreements. They do not abide by any rule. They're dangerous, and so you need to attack them. And this was said to be a mission that was supposed to be done in utmost secrecy, and the mushrikeen were not supposed to find out about this. A letter was sent with a female to go to Mecca and inform them. This female took that writing and rolled it up, somehow hid it in her hair. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi was notified by Jibra'il. Amir al-Mu'mineen, along with another companion of the Prophet, were sent, the two of them were sent to, and they were told who this person is. They were sent to go there, stop her, take the letter, and bring the letter back, and perhaps her as well. So she knew how dangerous this was, and that's why she had hid it in her hair. Amir al-Mu'mineen, along with the other companion, went. They stopped her, and they said, we need to search you. This is, I guess, maybe they said, this is what we're looking for, or they said that you have this. She denied it, perhaps. Some of those details, I'm not sure if they're recorded, but normally you would have something like that happening, a conversation, perhaps. Anyhow, she denied it or didn't tell them, and they searched whatever she had. They searched whatever she had, and they couldn't find it. Obviously, it's in her hair. I don't know how far they went in terms of it's two males, two men, body search. How could they? When they searched everything, and remember, paper, back then there was no paper. Writing was done in a different way. They would write on leather. They would write on other things. So how small could that have been? And how well could she have hidden it? Anyhow, after searching everything, and perhaps reaching those limitations where they can't search any further, these two companions of the Prophet react in two different ways. One of them, the one other than Ali ibn Abi Talib, says, well, we couldn't find it. Maybe there was a mistake. Maybe there was a mistake. Who? The Prophet made a mistake? That thought right there, that's the problem. That is an issue. Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullah wa salamuhu alayh, took out his dhulfiqar, his sword, and he said, I swear to God. This is an act of treason, what she had done. Okay, and she would have deserved death. Ali ibn Abi Talib knew that she's not strong enough to go for that. So anyhow, this is what he presented. He said, I swear to God, I will take your life here. The Prophet said, you have this letter. You either give it to me or you're dead. And she saw she has no other choice. She gave it. No torture, no nothing. Just this firmness that stemmed from his firm belief. Not even slightly, maybe there's the slightest mistake, because this is very serious. He says, I'm willing to take your life. If she is not a criminal that is betraying all these Muslimin, if she would have betrayed the Muslimin like that and caused the deaths of so many Muslimin, it would be on her. She deserves that death if she's committing that act of treason. If it's not that person, though, you killed an innocent person. That's a very severe thing. Ali ibn Abi Talib is absolutely sure. Why? Did he see it with her? No. The Prophet said. There is zero doubt. He said, this person, we identified this person, she confessed, that is her. There's no way on earth this letter is not with her. If it was not going to be with her when we found her, the Prophet would have told me, Ya Ali, when you get there, she might have dropped it. Ask her. No, you have it. The Prophet speaks Every word has a reason. وَمَا يَنْطِقُ عَنِ الْهَوَىٰ إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحْيٌ يُوحَىٰ. I am that certain that you had that letter. I am that certain you have it right now with you, and you are going to give it to me. Why? Because the Holy Prophet said, go get it. That means she had it, she has it. When you get there, she has. If I was not going to get there when she still carries it, the Prophet would have known and he would have told me. He didn't. He didn't. This is the way Ali ibn Abi Talib sees the words of the Prophet. We are in need of this, brothers and sisters. We are in need of this understanding towards the Qur'an, first and foremost. Every little detail in the Qur'an is a revelation from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There's no ifs or buts or maybe this or maybe this was for this time or that time. He would have mentioned it. If he didn't mention it, he knows everything all the way, not just to the last day of this world. He knows everything from the beginning to the end. هو الأول والآخر والظاهر والباطن وهو بكل شيء عليم. He is the creator of language, the creator of words, the creator of the Arabic language, the creator of all those words, phrases, sentences. He's the creator of the heavens and the earth and everything. Every word, letter, sentence, phrase, condition, qualifier, modifier, everything there is put there very precisely. Not one little bit more or one little bit less. If you read the verses, the understanding, we need to be as careful as we can to try to understand what is said. But not change it. Being careful with that is fine. But thinking that, well, this meaning, although the words are clear, but this meaning could not be intended. Why? Because we understand things this way. That can't be true. Well, you got to doubt your other understanding, brother or sister. Because this verse says what it says. If he wanted to imply a different meaning, convey a different meaning, he would have used different words. This is what he says. If you have other judgments, other findings as you think you do, and you think those are definite, those are correct, and this verse is conflicting with those, therefore those are correct, this verse must be wrong, you got to switch that up, I'm sorry. Switch that up. The verse is correct. That other understanding, now there's a big question mark on it. I got to correct that other understanding, not what the verse is saying. We must be like that towards the words of the Holy Prophet. Of course, as the Prophet said, anything attributed to him first needs to be checked with the verse. And the verse says of the Quran, if those don't conform, then that means the Prophet did not say or do that. Things that conform with the Quran and the guidance in it tells us that this account is accurate, then if, again, those words, that conduct does not sound right, does not match a certain other understanding that we have outside of the Quran, outside of the sayings of the Prophet, don't question the conduct of the Prophet and how accurate, how correct, how right that is. No. Question that other thing that you were certain before you read this, before you heard the Prophet said this or did this, and it was clear the Prophet did or say, he did say this, he did do that. Whatever it was that I was clear and sure of before this, there's a question mark on it now. When it doesn't, these two conflict, when there's a conflict between them. The same goes with the words of Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi. The same goes with the conduct and words of Imam al-Mujtaba, Imam al-Husayn, Imam Zain al-Abidin, all the way to the Imam of our time.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
As the COVID-19 pandemic upended the economy in the spring and summer of 2020, tens of millions of Americans lost their jobs and became ever more vulnerable to hunger. In consequence, the country's network of food banks saw a sudden spike in surge. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sasha Bromsky, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Food Insecurity is Much Higher Than Before COVID. As the COVID pandemic upended the economy in the spring and summer of 2020, tens of millions of Americans lost their jobs and became ever more vulnerable to hunger. In consequence, the country's network of food banks saw a sudden spike in usage. Just prior to and at the start of the pandemic, food banks distributed 1.1 billion pounds of food in the first quarter of 2020. By the fall of that year, they were handing out 1.7 billion pounds. Since then, that dizzying increase has leveled off or fallen somewhat in many places. But that doesn't mean the country is no longer suffering an epidemic of food insecurity. To the contrary, large food banks around the country are still reporting far far higher levels of food and a food distribution to attempt to meet that need than was the case prior to COVID. In Washington, D.C., for example, the big food banks are reporting an increase in usage of more than 60% compared to 2019. Put simply, as Thanksgiving rolls around again, millions of Americans are struggling to feed their families the bare minimum on a daily basis. If they are able to have a bigger spread, it will likely be only thanks to food charities and their volunteers and donors. Meanwhile, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, enrollment is up by 7 million compared to 2 years ago, with more than 42 million Americans now on food stamps. Of these, more than 4 in 10 are members of families with at least one person working. Throughout much of the South, upward of 15% of residents receive SNAP assistance. In New Mexico, the state with the highest rate of food stamp usage in the country, more than 1 in 5 residents are enrolled in SNAP. Looked at one way, these numbers and the resilience of SNAP in the face of long-standing conservative antipathy to the program are success stories. Tens of millions of Americans do not have enough economic security to easily feed themselves and their families. But thankfully, the country does not have an epidemic of starvation. Instead, its charitable networks have gone into overdrive, and a food distribution mechanism has been fine-tuned to keep hunger at bay for the vast majority of recipients. At the same time, SNAP has become the de facto story of an otherwise withered social safety net. Looked at another way, however, these numbers are a devastating indictment of the current U.S. economic model. In the world's richest country, with more billionaires than anywhere else on Earth, a large percentage of the population lacks the ability to set aside the financial resources to be able to easily feed themselves and their children. Instead, they have to fall back either on charity or on government assistance. Many people who rely on food aid have jobs, just not jobs that pay enough of a living wage to allow them to buy food for their families. In the South in particular, where in few places does the local minimum wage exceed the federal minimum of $7.25 per hour, less than half what it is in cities and states that moved toward the $15 per hour living wage in recent years, the scandal of food insecurity for the working poor remains omnipresent. This is a crisis in the United States, magnified, though by no means created, by the pandemic, not of food production failures, but of a skyrocketing inequality. There is clearly no shortage of food in the U.S., but there is a shortage of disposable income among a growing percentage of people at the bottom of the economy. Americans have, as a society, become inured to the stunning realities of families experiencing shortages of food amid a broader glut of staples. As the U.S. gears up to celebrate a holiday that for many people revolves around copious feasting with family and friends, that crisis has been exacerbated months of high inflation, especially in key sectors of the economy such as fuel and food. Some meats have increased in prices by nearly 10% this past year. More worryingly, this summer, in several food categories, such as eggs, prices began escalating by 3% per month. If that continues for a significant period of time, it will have massive impacts on the purchasing power of poor Americans, who already spend a vastly disproportionate part of their limited income on food. While the average amount of disposable personal income that Americans spend on food for preparing at home declined from 13.7% in 1960 to 5.7% in 2000, as incomes rose and as food costs declined, this has never held for poor Americans. In fact, the U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates from 5 years ago found that the poorest quintile of Americans were still spending between 28 and 42% of their pre-tax income on food. Given that low-income Americans are also being particularly hard hit by surges in prices for housing, fuel, and a range of consumer goods such as used cars, the inflationary trends with the food industry threaten to render their economic tightrope walk even more dangerous. As a result, even as the overall unemployment rate has returned to near pre-pandemic levels, with latest Bureau of Labor Statistics data showing 4.6% unemployment, even as overall poverty rates have gone down to nearly historically low levels due to huge levels of government intervention in the economy, food insecurity remains prevalent in the United States of America.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat, or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Basically, materialistic powers are intimidated by the word revolution. They are afraid of it, intimidated by it, and panic at the mention of the word Islamic revolution. So they have a reason for being afraid. Nonetheless, pressures are exerted with various excuses by the enemies. Sometimes they exert pressure while using the excuse of the nuclear issue. Sometimes they increase the pressure on Iran with the excuse of human rights and the like. But the truth of the matter is that the enemies of the Iranian people and of Islamic Iran are intimidated by and worried over the qualities that come with being a revolutionary. Lately, in recent months, an American politician said, sanctions are imposed on Iran because of the Islamic Revolution. The essence of sanctions originates from the revolution that was launched in 1979, the revolution of the year 1357. This is the reality.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What is the reason, and why are they opposed to the revolution? The reason is that this great, vast, blessed and rich country that enjoys both natural and human resources of wealth was completely caught up in their claws at once. It used to be under America's control, but the revolution took over and tossed them out. Their animosity towards the Islamic Revolution is owed to this fact. The revolution sent them away. Furthermore, it inspired others around the world too. The Islamic Revolution, which was launched and pursued by the people of Iran, became an inspiration for other nations. This issue requires a detailed discussion, and there are countless reasons for that. Our revolutionary Imam Rahmatullah Alayh pulled the country out of various quagmires. He pulled the country out of various morasses with the help of the Islamic Revolution.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.